Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby.
And together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will spotlight a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in! Okay, so...
How have you been?
It's been pretty cool. I'm podcasting from a different place today. I'm hanging out with my grandparents.
That's
and
nice.
And it's been so great so far. I came up for the holiday weekend and just packed all my stuff to record, and I'm going to stay for a little bit.
Oh, that's nice. How long are you planning to stay?
Like about a week and a half longer.
Oh, that's nice.
I filmed ahead a bunch, so it should be feasible.
You all don't know this, but I actually saw pictures of Abby's grandparents' backyard, and it's the dreamiest place ever, so I hope you have a great time.
It's amazing here. I'm always just so happy and at peace, yeah. even if it took a little while for internet to get up to these parts. Do we have any bunny updates?
Well, they're like, I want to say 2.5, 3 weeks old now. They're so cute.
Aww.
They were in this like wooden, we like have a little wooden house where the bunnies go in to sleep, and they were up there, and then they started to come out and like explore a little. They're eating, they're hanging out. It's the cutest thing. Yeah, my son runs up to them and like feeds them.
Aww.
It's so sweet. They're so cute. They're like, they sit in the palm of your hand. They're so tiny.
So little.
They're so sweet.
This is my favorite B plot of this podcast is Emma's baby bunnies.
They're so cute. Yeah. I try to do frequent updates on my Instagram stories, but sometimes I forget. But yeah, people are very invested into the bunnies.
All right. So do you want to just jump right into this?
Yes.
Let's get going. I'm excited for this episode.
Me too.
I'm not so much a music critic as I am, I say, a failed artist. I only sold one piece when I was 17. I went to art school that didn't work for me. So today's doll is kind of everything I wished I could have been. I'm not kidding when I say she is the reason the psychedelic 60s look the way they did. She influenced a whole movement of visual art and graphic design. She had this groundbreaking combination of Art Nouveau and psychedelia. Not to mention, she was an accessory to two of the most hectic and interesting years in Beatle history. Today's doll is artist and leader of the Fool Collective, Marijke Koger. One of the only substantial resources we have on Marijke's life and her time with the Fool is a series of posts she'd made on her blog. It serves as her memoir. She didn't want to deal with any book publishers. Imagine you writing your life story and then an editor is like, okay, let's take this and this out. Better to just post it yourself. Update from the video I made on the Fool probably 3 months ago now, Marijke is posting again.
This is so exciting.
She last updated her blog on May 3rd. This is new information that I will be including in the script. A lot of this blog acts as a transcript of the documentary her and her husband Don Dunham made in 2017. So if you want to learn more, if there's stories from this podcast that you want to know a little more about, you can watch that on YouTube and you can read her blog. Without those resources, this episode simply would not have been possible.
Yes, it is not lost on us that every subject of this series so far was affected in some way by World War II. Whether it was Sharon Tate's husband, Roman Polanski, escaping the Holocaust in his youth, Nico growing up surrounded by war-torn Berlin, or Grace Slick's relation to the war propaganda, the Second World War authored the entire generation that came of age in the 1960s. Today's doll is no different. Marijke Koger was born on November 6th. In 1943 to Anna Brore and her then husband Klaas Koger. I'm just gonna apologize here, I don't know Dutch, I'm trying my best. Their home of Amsterdam was in a chokehold, under such heavy siege that children found shrapnel on the beaches long after the war ended. Some of Marijke's earliest memories are of bunkers and the sound of bombs hurtling through the air. I imagine that to be absolutely terrifying. The only kind of idea that I have of how this situation might feel, in Germany, it is very common that whenever there's like a big new built project, they will find bombs in the ground.
No way!
Yes, it is a very common thing, especially in large cities. The city that I grew up in got completely destroyed, and so whenever they build, and I'd say this happens like several times a year, they will find a bomb, and they don't know whether it will explode or not. So they will evacuate all the people living there. I think most of like Germans' police departments have a bomb specialist, and they will come in and just make sure that everything is good. They will take out the bit that might explode and then take the bomb away. But I imagine, I mean,
that's crazy.
Yeah, and it's been 80 years, so I imagine in her childhood that must have been even more insane. Marijke was just 6 months old when her parents divorced. Anna leaving her husband was courageous to begin with. Divorce was unheard of in the 1940s. But it was Anna and her baby's escape from Amsterdam that took insurmountable bravery. Since the train lines were shut down, Anna had to walk all 50 miles to her mother's home city of Rotterdam. Mother and child made it through an SS roadblock with a young Jewish boy Anna hid in the bottom of Marijke's carriage. Famine struck in the winter of 1944. Supplies were so low that Anna, her mother, and little Marijke ate tulip bulbs to survive.
That was one of the parts of her blog memoir that made me emotional reading it, especially so early in her life. That took so much bravery on Anna's part. After the war, Anna and her now 2-year-old daughter returned to Amsterdam. Because she was a single mother and couldn't afford a nanny, she had to bring Marijke to work every day. An army veteran named Piet van der Pol told his parents of Anna's situation. If she wanted to keep working, she had to find a place for Marijke to stay. Luckily, Piet's parents took pity on Anna and offered to foster her little girl. Quote, "The green door at number 16, Kranpenstraat, opened, and I was facing many steep steps curving up to the flash of a large auburn-colored dog with big golden eyes. I forgot the nagging fear of the unknown and new environment and ran as fast as my 2-year-old legs could manage to a laughing Irish setter. All was well with the world. Ida was to be my constant companion for the next 10 years. End quote. Marijke had a wonderful child with the van der Pols. The neighborhood was quiet and pretty, with no cars to be found. The only traffic was the farmer and his horse. So began Marijke's lifelong love of horses. Peter and Helena van der Pol, whom she affectionately called her opa and tante, enrolled her in a good school, dance lessons and swimming lessons as well. Marijke excelled in all fields. She won a medal for her backstroke and auditioned for the ballet company as a teen. Opa and tante had 3 sons, Piet, Evert, and I'm relying on Emma's pronunciation for this name because I have never seen anything like it in English, Joop. Piet was a quiet and gentle man. Joop and his wife Engel were around often. Engel was a fashionable young woman who worked at a chocolate shop. She no doubt inspired Marijke's sweet tooth and passion for fashion. But Evert was Marijke's favorite. After working with the resistance in the war and receiving a medal for his bravery, he became a chemist for work. In his free time, he was a wonderful painter. He gave Marijke her first experience with paints, as well as teaching her how to read. By all accounts, Marijke was a part of the family, acting as flower girl for all the van der Pol boys' weddings. As lovely as her opa, tante, and brothers were, there was one thing missing. Quote, "Even though I missed my mother, whose weekend visits became more and more sporadic, causing me quite some trauma, I was the luckiest girl in the world to end up with such a wonderful family." All Marijke really saw of her blood family in this point in her life was on summer break, when she'd spend time with her aunt and cousins.
That is until Anna and her new husband, Wim, suddenly entered the picture. Though Marijke was not invited to the wedding, Anna wanted her to come and stay with them. There was a good school for her to attend. She had a new sibling on the way. They would all be one happy family. Marijke and her baby brother, Willem, were made to sleep in a cramped room, doubling as a storage room and office for Wim's work as a traveling lingerie salesman. Wim was a cold, shrewd man, in quotes, suspicious about everyone and everything. Even Marijke's foster family were subject to his questioning. It was nice to get to know her mother more. They had the same dark hair and love of reading. Anna taught her how to read in English, but both Wim and Anna were alcoholics. When they'd drink, they'd lash out at each other and their children. Tiring of the abuse, Marijke ran back to her aging opa and tante every chance she got. As Marijke became a teen, her curiosity surrounding her father grew. Anna forbade her from ever speaking about him. One day she looked up her last name in the phone book, found a tailor named Koher, and rang the shop's doorbell. A man with bright green eyes answered, the same as her own. It was Klaas Koher. Miraculously, Klaas and his new wife Wilma put their shock aside and invited Marijke inside. There she was, met by two half-sisters, and walls upon walls of seascapes her father painted. They were all kind, but Klaas was very quiet. Though he welcomed his daughter in his home, he never spoke a single word to her. That must be hard. I can just imagine you having so many questions if you've never really met your father. Mm-hmm. So even though they were inviting to her, which is far more than what Nico ever got, yeah, it's still kind of... I don't know, it's a weird feeling, I guess.
It's a weird situation all around. I mean, imagine Wilma and this, like, random teenage girl knocks on your door and you discover, my husband has a whole other family. I can't imagine the shock. In chapter 2 of her blog, the chapter we're covering of her life right now, Marijke identifies herself as being on the autism spectrum. Her exact words were, quote, a dash of Asperger's. This does make sense. Throughout her life, Marijke is very introverted, describes several situations where she completely missed social cues, and one could call the arts her special interest. She doesn't outright state her father was on the spectrum as well, but she compares his withdrawn, aloof nature, artistic ability, and hyper-focus on seascapes to her own habits in such a way that suggests it. Mm. When Marijke came home that day, she excitedly told her mother that she'd found her father. Anna responded by striking her daughter so hard that she went partially deaf. That broke my heart.
Yeah, that's hard.
Volatile as Marijke's mother and stepfather could be, they enrolled her in the Académie des Champs. The Academy was an all-girls school with special focus on the arts, drawing, painting, art history, fashion design, and music. Marijke thrived both socially and artistically. At 13 years old, she'd already sold her artwork in galleries. While studying at the Academy, Marijke befriended this episode's secondary doll, if you will, Yasha Leger. Yasha was a bright and social girl with a passion for fashion, and together, the girls made a great team. Marijke would draw designs from things they oohed and awed at in fashion magazines, Yasha would sew them up, and all the girls in their classes would be so jealous. School was Marijke's escape from her home life. After one incident in which Wim tried to get 15-year-old Marijke to model lingerie for him, she ran away. She hitchhiked all the way to the south of France, even finding a waitressing job there. One thing about Marijke is that she's intensely self-sufficient. It's sad that this came from her unstable situation at home, but this skill serves her very well later in life. When she lost her waitressing job and money ran out, she hitchhiked all the way back to Amsterdam, only to find she was on Interpol's missing children list. As a punishment for running away, Wim withdrew her from the Academy. Anna did nothing to stop it. In response, Marijke moved out and found another job.
Marijke's life is full of fantastic coincidences. Just when she left home at the tender age of 15, a job opened up at the wholesale office of C&A department store. She would have to sketch each of the thousands of pieces the store sold. It was tedious work, but it paid good money, enough for Marijke's first apartment. While she was still a teenager, mind you. One might call her something of a child prodigy. Another thing about Marijke is that she's very brave. She knocked on her birth father's door at 13, lived on her own for the first time at 15, and at 16 she brought her portfolio to the biggest advertising agency in Amsterdam. She started out in Pret's cut and paste department, but quickly worked her way up to an illustrator's position. Thus began her madman days, as she described them. It was the early 1960s in an advertising firm not unlike Don Draper's. Her look reminds us of a blonde Joan Holloway. Marijke cut and dyed her hair blonde and rocked wiggle dresses and pencil skirts Yasha made.
We're gonna have those photos on the Dolls Pod Instagram because she looks so cute with her little, like, French office girl look.
Oh, she really does. I think it is so interesting how much she changed in her appearance and the way that she dressed. You can still recognize her because she has this very distinct face and she's like a very pretty girl, but in her own way.
With these like very feline, like cat eyes.
Yeah. She's truly beautiful. She was invited to the staffers' parties, where her mingling landed commissions from the galleries Lafayette. From this, she was able to continue studying art in Paris. Marijke made so much money working at Pratt that she bought herself a Jaguar before she could legally drive.
That is what I call fuck you money. Like, I'm gonna buy a car even though I can't drive it.
That's crazy.
I love that.
It's such a good mentality. But the workplace culture was very much like Mad Men. The boys would drink in the office and womanize with no consequence. So she left Pratt to go freelance, never once looking back. Amsterdam became a beatnik hotspot in the early 1960s. They appreciated jazz music, pot smoking, and the arts, so Marijke fit right in. Around 1962, she met fellow beatnik Simon Posthuma.
Not my type, but I see the vision.
I don't know how to put this. I feel the same. He's attractive, but not for me. But I can see why someone would find him attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Simon was older, the rebellious son of a policeman and his wife. Despite dropping out of school and getting kicked out of art school for, in quotes, having no talent, he became an abstract expressionist painter and luminary of the building avant-garde scene. It is safe to say he was pretty out there. He'd light his chest hair on fire at parties.
Oh my God.
He seems like a fun guy to be around.
Life of the party, truly.
He really does. Oh yeah, he was. Not to mention he'd already tried LSD. He had the gift of gab, once talking himself and Marijke out of jail for accidentally cross-dressing in Morocco. He was very charming too, promising Marijke the world and more. Though he had a wife, a 3-year-old child, and a girlfriend already, Marijke couldn't resist him. When Simon abandoned his wife and child for the city of Wittenberg, Marijke followed him there. The couple took up residence in the artist's neighborhood there and painted their flat floor to ceiling. Their art making was soundtracked by a modest record collection from the hottest rock and roll groups. They loved the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, and the Animals. At this point in life, Marijke developed her distinct art style, influenced by Art Nouveau, Eastern philosophies, astrology, Greek and Roman mythology, Native American stories, ancient Egypt, the Middle Ages, and psychedelic drugs.
I think part of that, having such an eclectic art style, came from all of the books she read.
Oh, yeah.
She was a voracious reader, and I'm sure that extended into art history books. She did study art history.
Yeah, it just seems like she got inspired by everything that she saw. Yeah. She was like a sponge taking it all in, but she didn't replicate it, but turning it into her own thing.
Quote, "The early 60s blew the lid off the bubbling cauldron of music and art with new sounds and visions. There was magic in the air." Calling the avant-garde scene Marijke and Simone flew in wild is an understatement. Simone organized the Stoned in the Streets happenings with some truly outrageous characters. Free jazz played, Bart Hughes revealed his third eye, Peter Bergman read his poetry, and Marijke painted her whole body. Meanwhile, she and Yasha worked their first clothing boutique, The Trend. It was part store, part art gallery, part jazz club, and part hair salon. The whole operation ran by celebrity hairdresser Mario Wellman. Yasha and Marijke sold their space-age-inspired flashing fashions, while Simone occupied the gallery. Things were going great, until Mario was busted for embezzlement and fled the country.
This is wild.
There are so many crazy turns in this story like that one.
She seemed to have a hand for running into the most insane people.
Yes! Taking this as their sign from the universe to start anew, Simone and Marijke left the Netherlands. But before the couple left, Klaus dropped by unannounced. Quote, he rang the doorbell, clomped up the bare wooden stairs, and, still not saying anything, sat down at the piano and played something while I made tea. And then he left again. I guess it was his way of saying he cared about me after all. It would be the last time Marijke ever saw her father. The couple lived a bohemian life together, bouncing around Greece and North Africa before making their way out to Spain in 1965. From Madrid to Valencia they went, before stopping on an island central to our last episode, Ibiza. Besides the bugs in their apartment, Marijke, you're a greater woman than me, I can't do bugs. Marijke adored Ibiza. It was still untouched by tourists, save for a few artist types to make fast friends with. She remembers executing performance art with Simone at a pool party, making an action painting, and jumping through it at the end. There's video of this on YouTube, by the way. They redid it in 1971 or 72, and they got video of it. Their couple's experimenting with LSD continued. They partook on the beach one night, but Marijke took too much. Simone panicked and, instead of calling the police or a medic to help his overdosing girlfriend, brought her to some lady he vaguely knew's apartment, then kicked said lady out of the apartment in case Marijke died. Thankfully, she lived. She lived. Upon waking up, she discovered she had what we might call an ego death. Among the couple's inner circle was a young photographer named Carl Ferris. Carl developed a special method to capture vibrant purples and pinks in his work. It was one step above infrared film. Carl and the yet-to-be-formed Fool Collective would go on to dictate how the psychedelic 60s would look. A lot of Marijke and Simone's work crops up in Carl's work. But for now, they were forming their own little scene on the Spanish island. Marijke would make clothes for herself and Carl's wife Anka to wear. But by 1966, Simone and Marijke's adventurous spirit tugged at them once again. Thanks to some friends they met back in Madrid, they were brought to swinging London. This is where things really pick up.
Yeah, I love this part. I feel like with every episode, you have that starting period, it's fine, and then at like one point, it just goes off the rails.
It just takes off. Yeah.
I love that. Things really took off for the couple in London. Carl did well too. He photographed album art for the Jimi Hendrix Experience and Donovan. Marijke and Simon's kindly old landlord allowed them to paint up their apartment and all the furniture in it. Simon's daughter came here to stay with them for a time. Marijke has no children of her own, but thanks to her free spirit and vibrant imagination, she's always been good with kids. The couple quickly found work in London as artists and fortune tellers. That's a great combo.
Yes.
Simon would do all the talking, getting the world out about him and his partner's work. Then Marijke would draw up beautiful swirling images to be printed and sold at Granny Takes a Trip and the Indica Boutique. Her art style was exactly what the psychedelic London scene needed. Through their adventures, they met Graham Bond and his band, the Graham Bond Organization. He became a dear friend to the couple, introducing them to tarot cards and writings by Aleister Crowley. The idea of black magic frightened Marijke. Tarot, on the other hand, she found beautiful, especially the idea of card number 0 of the Rider-Waite Tarot. The Fool. It is both the beginning and the end of the deck, representing innocence, freedom, and new beginnings. In quotes, symbolic of the cosmic egg, whence come all things into being and where all things return to, as Marijke says. It's worth noting many jesters and fools show up in medieval masterworks. which Marijke would have studied. By 1967, Simon befriended publicist Simon Hayes and PR man Barry Finch. Hayes connected the couple to all the biggest bands in London. They lent their Art Nouveau meets Medieval Times meets Acid Trip style to The Hollies, Procol Harum, The Incredible String Band, and The Move. Meanwhile, Barry passed word of his friend's crazy art along to Robert Stigwood, manager of Cream. Cream took their patronage to the next level, commissioning custom instruments and costumes for their first US tour. They were making their debut with The Who, so they had to stand out. Marijke oversaw clothes making while her partner sanded down Eric Clapton's 1946 Gibson SG and Jake Bruce Fender 6 bass. Marijke painted the fronts of the guitars with cherubs and inundating circles while Simon painted the backs and fretboards. Carl Ferris managed to photograph the guitars before the rainbow gradients were removed.
SG necks are hard enough to navigate as is. SGs in general, they're quite fragile guitars.
The project was a big success. The Fool SG became Clapton's new favorite guitar. He used it to record all of Cream's second album, Disraeli Gears, featuring their greatest hits Sunshine of Your Love and Strange Brew.
Great record.
Yeah, these are two of my most listened to songs, I'm sure. Not long after the Cream project was finished, Yasha joined Marijke and Simon in London. It was love at first sight for her and Barry. With their partnership, the Fool Collective was born. Everybody had a job in this group. Marijke and Simon were the artists and designers. Yasha was the seamstress, and Barry just kind of did whatever the other three needed him to do. Project manager, publicist, hand drum player, no problem, Barry did it all. And by the way, there were two more important figures Simon Hayes introduced the Fool to, Mel Evans and Brian Epstein, roadie for and manager of the Beatles.
No, the Fool did not paint John Lennon's Rolls Royce, and they didn't get to do the gatefold for Sgt. Pepper's. But in their two-year partnership, the Fool were essential components to the Beatleverse. Marijke was one of many famous faces who attended the recording of A Day in the Life. In the music video, we see Monkey Mike Nesmith in his Texas cowboy clothes, chatting with mustachioed John. Meanwhile, Marijke is there with her bright red hair and tambourine. Truly a clash of the worlds. Just Mike Nesmith there in general is so funny to me because he wasn't into all of the psychedelic stuff at all. Yeah. He was just like, let me write my country music and I'm going to be all set.
Honestly, this is a recording session I would have loved to attend. Yes. All these people there, the energy, the talks that they must have had, it seems like a perfect recording.
And the whole orchestra too, just watching them do that big crescendo. Ugh. It's chills down my spine.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs.
Marijke and Simone painted a piano for John and a big circular mural on the fireplace of George Harrison and Patty Boyd's home. Marijke and Yasha fashioned a purple velvet coat for George to wear to Monterey Pop and several outfits for Patty to wear. I'm in the process of remaking one of them. The vintage girlies know which one it is. It's right across from me right now. That's the whole bucket with all the sewing supplies in it. So
I cannot wait to see that.
We get to see it, but you people don't get to see it.
That's
the front and the back.
It's so good. The fabric is so good. You found such... Wow. It's identical almost.
I have no idea how I found something that close. Great.
Wow.
Broadcast on June 25th, 1967, the Our World special was the first live worldwide television broadcast. To represent Europe, the Beatles were to record a brand new song, All You Need Is Love. As a thank you for the Fool's hard work on costumes for this show and the Magical Mystery Tour film, Simone and Marijke were invited to participate. Everyone was there. Patty Boyd, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones, Graham Nash of the Hollies, Keith Moon of The Who, and Eric Clapton. We need to add him to Dolls Pod Bingo, I think.
I was just gonna say, Brian Jones there, and that would have been another bingo.
Yeah. Working with the biggest band in the world got the Fool serious clout. They even got a feature in the September 1967 hippie issue of Rave magazine. I own this issue, so I can pull a little bit from that article. Here's a couple quotes. quote, Simone, Marijke, Yasha, and Barry are part of a new generation of artists, pop artists who are using pop music and stars and fashion to bring their work before us. Later, quote, surrounded by the things and the people they love, they gently, persuasively expound their philosophy and outline their plans. It is a philosophy based on love. The essence is love. Love will grow, spread until the whole world is turned onto it. Love will not die. Everybody must turn on. That is the perfect description of who the Fool were and what they were all about. It was two couples who were so into the peace and love thing, and they just wanted to spread it to the world through their art and their clothes, and they weren't restricted to one form of art at all. They really did it all.
Yeah, it's beautiful to see, honestly. It kind of reminds me a little of Andy Warhol, as in that, like, pop artists crowd, I want to say. I don't know if they ever worked together. I feel like even though their way of working might have been similar, they were very different people from, like, what I have read. Because the Fool seems like a very nice crowd to hang around with. With Andy Warhol, we heard from several accounts that, you know, it wasn't always that nice. Mm-hmm. But I think it is interesting that in the 1960s, there was this movement of artists coming up where there truly weren't any boundaries. Artists, you weren't only a painter. You were painting, doing mixed media. Mm-hmm. You were just doing whatever you wanted. And I really love that.
I love that too. Really, I think the only thing you have to worry about with hanging with the Fool is, like, drinking out of the wrong coffee pot and whoops, I'm on LSD now.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't want that,
then just, like, don't drink the coffee and you'll be good.
Bring your own drink.
Yes. 1968 brought the Fool's two most notable projects in the Beatleverse, Wonderwall and the Apple Boutique. Contrary to popular belief, Wonderwall was not their first or only experience with film. That was Modesty Blaze back in 66. Emma, you studied film, you've worked in the film industry. What do you think of Wonderwall?
I have to say, I self-studied. I never went to school for it. I always wanted to. They turned me down because they didn't like women there. It's a whole different story. It was the craziest thing that has ever happened to me. But yeah, this movie, it is truly something else. There is sort of a story, but you get the feeling that the entire movie isn't about the story. It's just about the visuals. Mm-hmm. You go into this wonder world and there's Jane Birkin right into it. She's like kind of like the main character, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And she just dances and wanders around these wonderful worlds. It's an amazing movie, honestly. I feel like for some people, if you only know current day movies, it is very different to watch. Yes. But I would highly encourage you to push through the first, I don't know, 15 minutes of confusion. Mm-hmm. Because it is truly worth it. It is absolutely beautiful to look at.
You did a little Wonderwall reference with a friend of the show, Sam's Time Capsule. Yes. You did a little video together.
Yeah, we were both big fans of that movie. Yeah. We both come from, like, a filmmaking background, so that was definitely something we wanted to do for a long time.
I do still want to make a full film and soundtrack review of Wonderwall, so I won't, like, say too much of what I feel here, even though I have so many feelings, and it's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
But I will say, the soundtrack George Harrison made for it is quite nice.
It is.
And the film is named for a rainbow armoire Marijke and Simone had in their apartment.
Wow.
However weird Wonderwall is, you can't deny it's a stunning film to look at, thanks to Yasha's costumes for Jane Birkin, Marijke and Simone's set design, and Marijke's whimsical title cards.
Yeah, I have a background in set design. That was kind of like what I did. Yeah.
That was your focus.
I mean, I did directing and, like, writing a lot. Mm-hmm. I, like, made a lot of short films, wanted to go to school for it. You, like, need a lot of experience working on set. So mm-hmm. I decided to go into set design because it, like, really interested me. And it was great. From a set designing perspective, this is the dream thing. Like, I was doing crime shows and stuff. That wasn't as exciting.
Really?
I can only imagine how great doing something like this is, because all I did was, like, splattering fake blood everywhere and, like, writing fake boards of someone investigating a case that, yeah, that was kind of, like, more what I did.
Hold on. You got to make the conspiracy boards?
Yes. A lot of them.
I love
those. So many of them.
I want one of those in my house, but for this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you who don't know German television, which I guess most of you are, German television is 90% or like 60% is crime shows, 30% is medical shows, and then there's 10% for something else. But these are like the two top things.
Yeah, that's not too far off from here now that I think of it. Again, as a thank you for their hard work, the Fool Collective makes a cameo appearance in the film's party scene. Here's what Marijke had to say about filming. Quote, "Director Joe Masseau asked me to do a mystical dance number to the music we recorded with George. I suffer from a mild inferiority complex, so that I considered the proposal with trepidation, but after some time I swallowed my angst and did it anyway, but was not very happy with the result, because they only shot one take."
Which, that take you can now see in a reel that we put on our Instagram, because it is just so hypnotizing, you cannot stop looking at her.
One thing you'll notice when reading Marijke's blog is that she is her own harshest critic. That is such an artist thing. She doesn't find herself very pretty, and often comes down on herself hard over things she deems as past failures, but I don't know if this was the same for you, how you first came across Wonderwall, but the first thing I ever saw of the film was the party scene with Marijke dancing. I thought she looked so beautiful in the costume. I was so enchanted by her that I had to seek out the rest of the movie.
Yeah, you're immediately drawn to her because she just stands out. There's this crowd and this film is filled with colors, but she clearly stands out.
She has an aura about her. In the little bit of film footage that I've seen of The Fool, it's like you have a stage presence, but through your life, and it's a quiet presence.
Yeah, it seems like when you meet her or you see her in a room, you immediately look at her. It's like all eyes on her, and she doesn't intend to do it, but it's just she is so... Yeah, it's probably her aura, as you said. You're just drawn to looking at her and listening to her.
Due to the collective not being in the British Screen Actors or Set Painters Guild, The Fool were only given a cameo credit as opposed to being listed as the set designers. Sadly, after production wrapped, Wonderwall's namesake armoire was lost to the sands of time. The whole film was nearly lost after the US distribution deal fell through. It survives today thanks to its cult following. You know, people like the two of us, and a home video release, which Marijke designed the packaging for.
It's actually the one good thing about the fact that it didn't really get distributed is the fact that you can find it on YouTube, and you can just go there in the minute that this podcast ends and watch it.
Yes, the box for, I think it was a VHS release, the box is the armoire, and it opens up, and there's the tape. It's so cool.
It's so well made. As for the boutique, the financiers at Apple Corps identified £2 million that could either be paid in taxes or invested in a new business venture. The guys chose the business venture, never mind that they didn't have a manager after Brian Epstein's death and no clue how to run a clothing store. Marijke and Yosha worked at a boutique before. They knew how to make clothes. What could possibly go wrong? So much. Paul McCartney envisioned the boutique as, in quotes, a beautiful place where people could buy beautiful things. It wasn't just a store, but a symposium too. Everything inside was designed by The Fool. The bright, medieval-inspired clothes, psychedelic prints, interior decor, even the staircase painted with moons and stars. Again, we thank Carl Ferris for immortalizing the store in his photography. The piece de resistance was a huge, multi-story mural of a Native American chief with a yin and yang orb. Marijke says the image came to her in a dream, a synthesis of the mythologies of different cultures and ethnicities influenced by hallucinogens. Who helped the fool paint it? A handful of local art students, including Mickey Finn, not yet of T-Rex. That's great.
The bongo man! I love him!
I love how in these episodes people will come up who will later have this wonderful career and you just don't know. The grand opening was a beautiful event with the Beatles, Twiggy, and Eric Clapton in attendance.
Oh my god!
There was a fountain in the middle of the store and The Fool played their folk instruments for their happy guests. It was quite literally all downhill from here. The Beatles were much better musicians than businessmen. They gave absolutely no parameters of a budget for The Fool. The clothes were wildly expensive and not very wearable. After all, they were costume designers. Furthermore, the brocades and silk came from Morocco, and a huge shipment got lost right before the store was opened. As stunning as the huge mural outside was, it caused traffic jams. Getting a permit slipped through the cracks, and the City of London forced them to paint it over all white. That's sad. As a whole, the store was more like a tourist attraction. Theft was a huge issue. And seeing as friends of the Beatles like Jenny Boyd were the managers, they had no clue what to do to stop it. After months of bleeding money, the Beatles shuttered the Apple Boutique on July 31st in 1968. Their grand finale? Giving the remaining inventory away. Ringo remembers, in quotes, "We went in the night before and took everything we wanted. We had loads of shirts and jackets. We cleaned a lot of stuff out. It wasn't a sale, we just gave it away, and that was the best idea." Marijke adds, in quotes, "I thought that was an appropriate grand finale of the whole production to the benefit of the public, a kind of new age bonfire of the vanities. Fans lined up all the way around the block in hopes of snagging something for free. It was such a spectacle that news crews came to capture the..."
Sorry, I love this word, brouhaha.
That's a great word. There's a German word, really similar, I think, which will describe the same thing. It's tohu wabohu.
Isn't that good? Can you spell that for me and write it in a text and send it?
Yeah, I will.
Because I love...
It's a great word.
I love extremely specific German words.
Chohuwabohu is just utter chaos.
Yes.
You don't know what even go on anymore.
And that was the closing of the Apple Boutique. There's news footage, again, on YouTube. And people are just, like, ransacking the place, taking armfuls of clothes and stuff off the walls. They would have taken the staircase if they could, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. It is wild. And I think it is kind of sad because the Apple Boutique was such a wonderful place. Yeah. And the idea of having a store like that was so good. I feel like if Brian Epstein would have still lived, maybe he would have been able to kind of like guide them in a way to make this work, because I feel like the idea isn't terrible. Yeah. It's just the execution was pretty terrible, and this wasn't even really anyone's fault. They just all didn't knew better.
Yeah. And it was supposed to be a workshop too. They were supposed to be teaching art classes there. That would have been awesome.
Imagine going to one of those.
Imagine just being there, owning a piece of clothing from the Apple Boutique. Like, I see that stuff go up for auction. It is so expensive now.
It's insane, yeah.
But it's beautiful stuff. Yasha was really talented.
Yeah, she was.
The Beatles and the Fool grew apart after the shop closed, but they maintained connections with other musicians, namely Graham Nash and Graham Bond. The collective would jam with whichever musicians they hung out with, playing their folk instruments and drums. Simone even had bagpipes. Once again, by spectacular coincidence, Mercury exec Irving Green came knocking on the Fool's door. The idea was for them to make an album. They'd write all their own lyrics, arrange all the songs, and play what instruments they could. Of course, they'd make their own album art too. That's kind of a given. Graham and Graham would take care of all the rest. Here's what Marijke had to say about it. Quote, "Not being professional musicians at all, we were completely taken by surprise, of course, but also pleased, especially Simone and Barry. All in all, it was an offer we could not refuse."
It kind of reminds me of the GTO's album, Permanent Damage.
Yes.
Where, like, a bunch of very creative people come together and make an album that is really otherworldly, mostly because they don't know what they're doing, but I think that's always great. This album, The Fool One, is actually up on YouTube, too. YouTube is a great source for this.
Yes. Shout out to YouTube.
Yeah, it's good for us in all the ways.
Yes. The transatlantic ferry trip was awful. Though there were lots of vegetarian foods for Marijke to eat, she was horribly seasick for the whole journey. They stopped in New York before settling in California, where Marijke will remain for the rest of her life. The Fool cut their first and only album at the Record Plant in Sausalito, California. They were among the first of a long line of acts to use the Record Plant, from Sly and the Family Stone to Fleetwood Mac. Marijke said, quote, "I keenly felt our lack of musicianship, but we were honest folk performers and we put everything we had into the sessions. I was very insecure about the whole thing and longed to be painting, but it was remarkable how well the whole album came together. But she does remember a fun session in which the Grams were trying to capture a certain distant, Doppler effect on Simone's bagpipes, so he walked away from the mic and slowly towards it again while playing, but every time, without fail, he'd bang into the doorframe. But this is the big long pipes. You just couldn't
have
despite everyone rolling at the spectacle, they managed to get a decent take. After much encouragement from Graham and Graham, the quote, infinite patience of recording engineer Eddie Kramer, and 3 months of production, The Fool's self-titled album was released. The best way I can describe how The Fool's album sounds is like a commune of hippies who time traveled back to the Middle Ages and then gave the serfs magic mushrooms, and they're also in space with lasers somehow.
That's good.
It's weird, it's wild, it's wonderful, there's bagpipes. It's psychedelic folk perfection, and this thing sank like the Titanic. Mercury exec Bob Reno said, quote, I vomited when the LP was released. It was dreadful and sold about 3 copies. Ouch.
Honestly, this is kind of what Nico experienced. She was making a record and everyone was like, yeah, no, people are gonna die if they hear this.
To be fair, it only sold about 3 copies because it wasn't promoted well. You'd think The Fool would have painted a big mural on the Sunset Strip, or maybe designed billboards. That would have been awesome, but alas, no such thing came to be.
The failure of the album was no matter, though. The Fool were about to embark on their most iconic project to date, and their last hurrah. In 1969, the hippie musical Hair was set to open in LA. Producer Michael Butler plus Smothers' brother Tommy Smother commissioned The Fool for the largest mural in the world at the time, on the newly christened Aquarius Theater. The mural of all 12 zodiac signs, the 4 elements, 9 muses, and 3 faced mountain took 2 months of 12-hour workdays to complete. An army of assistants from nearby art schools were recruited to help, as Yasha was heavily pregnant and could not work. The project was a major success and got The Fool more work. When the Gary Theater in San Francisco and Schubert Theater in Chicago put on productions of Hair, The Fool painted more murals, but once again worked dried up. Yosha and Barry were married on August 16th in 1969 as Apollo 11 took off to the moon. She gave birth to the first of the couple's 6 children and opened a boutique of her own. Meanwhile, Marijke and Simon teamed up with Michael Butler to embark on Cosmic Couture and the Summer Sunday clothing line. These designs are stunning, modeled by the likes of Raquel Welch. They're made of gauzy fabrics and pastel rainbow hues. A much more 70s take on The Fool's medieval revival style. These designs are very hard to find nowadays, cherished by collectors like groupie queen Pamela DeBar. Why are they so hard to find? Because, we kid you not, Michael backed out of the project after his astrologer told him he shouldn't be involved in the fashion industry. This led to Cosmic Couture being abandoned. Thankfully, Marijke found Bill Berman, who got the Astrobeam clothing line into Macy's stores.
How does an astrologer go about that?
This is like such an oddly specific... I was just gonna say that. It is so wild. Like, I also wonder, what did he say? Like, if you do this, you're gonna die? The clothing line is evil? Like, what's gonna happen? What's the worst that can happen?
I don't know.
You're gonna drown in a pile of clothing? I don't know. At Simon's behest, the couple kept making music under their own names this time. But behind the scenes, after nearly a decade together, the relationship began to strain. Old habits die hard, and in the 70s, Simon was back to his cheating, neglectful ways. Marijke remembers one particularly distressing incident in which Simon had left her at a massive pool painting job. It was over 100 degrees that day. The pool paint was very toxic. Simon left her to take another girl out while Marijke passed out of heat stroke. Nevertheless, Marijke soldiered on, making the Son of America and Mediterranean Blues albums with him. Accompanying Son of America was a huge rainbow resin sculpture of Jack Tyree, with a neon sign. It's truly a sight to behold. Marijke wasn't ever very fond of making music, feeling terribly insecure about her lack of skill. But she did it anyway for him. They even had a minor hit in 1973. Their single, I Saw You, made them unlikely pop stars back home in the Netherlands. For the first time in 5 years, Marijke returned to her home of Amsterdam. There she saw her dear tante for the last time at Everett's house. Through the couple's lasting friendship with Graham Nash, they became tight friends with Joni Mitchell, Rita Coolidge, and Kris Kristofferson, and Rita's brother-in-law, Booker T. Jones. Booker T. wrote all the arrangements and brought in his band to play while Joni and Rita provided backing vocals.
Marijke and Simone's relationship continued to unravel amongst Simone's erratic behavior and heavy drinking. He would disappear on days-long binges, cheating relentlessly. One time, he disappeared to New Mexico, returning with a horse who died a few days later. The couple moved into a log cabin together where things got totally out of hand. As Simone became abusive, art became Marijke's escape. In late 1974, Simone left her for a girlfriend he met at a party. He gave their horses away and took the German Shepherd and their car, leaving Marijke and her two dachshunds to pick up the pieces. For the first time in 12 years, she was on her own. After being so suddenly abandoned by her longtime partner, she dealt with terrible anxiety over living on her own and having to start all over again. But love found her again in the form of her first husband named Gard. He shared her fascination with outer space. He was an aerospace engineer, after all. In 1982, the mayor of Los Angeles and his wife helped Marijke put on her first exhibition in years. It was a great success, with Everett coming all the way from Amsterdam to see. She kept painting murals through the 80s, all while living on the ranch she shared with Gard. But after 14 years of marriage, he too ran off with another woman. Once again, she picked up the pieces, having to sell one of her beloved horses to make ends meet. Through it all, making art was her repose.
So what became of Marijke's most famous pieces? Lots of her art is featured in the 2012 book Electrical Banana, Masters of Psychedelic Art. Prints of her art are available on her website too. You can also still find Wonderwall and copies of The Fool's album if you know where to look. The album was repressed for its 50th anniversary. After spending some time in Todd Rundgren's hand, The Fool SG was sold at auction to a longtime owner. In 2019, it was exhibited at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with Jack's Fender 6 bass. Last year, the SG went up for auction again, where it sold for a whopping $1.2 million. The Apple Boutique has long since been painted over. But in 2008, the BBC projected the mural onto the corner of Baker Street for an Apple 40th anniversary special. Patty Boyd was in attendance. Speaking of Patty, earlier this year, the dresses Marijke designed for her sold at auction for between $3,000 and $5,000 each. And thanks to Quentin Tarantino and his 2019 film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you can visit the Aquarius Theater in LA.
I really want to go see that.
Me too. I've never been...
Reading the blog, it seems like Marijke isn't a fan of the Aquarius repainting. Like, I guess some of the faces weren't quite right, and there was, like, some gradients they didn't get quite right. But I still do really want to see it. It's...
Me too.
The closest I can get to the real thing. I also... Why don't they just project the Apple mural on Baker Street all the time?
I don't get it either, because I don't know what the building is used for now, but I went there, like, I've been to London a couple
you
of
did.
Times. Yeah, it's not that far from here. We will actually go to London this fall again. Bring the baby. It's gonna be interesting.
Oh.
It's the first time
on... Is this your first trip with the baby?
No, but the first time flying. We already took him to Poland and Austria. And, like, a couple of other places. But in Europe, everything is just so close. So, like, London isn't that far. You can get there really inexpensively. And I've been in, like, in the Baker Street. That building is just boring now. So I really don't get why you wouldn't set up a projector. Or you could even say that this is, like, a cultural thing. You could repaint it, put a sign up, say this is what it was. I don't get why you just don't do that. Because I bet it would be a nice little tourist attraction. Not a lot
of
people...
It would be super popular.
Yeah, I think so too. I love these pictures. If you look up old pictures of the street, you can clearly... This building always stands out to you. Even like the corner Carnaby and Baker Street, you can clearly see it there in the background of so many pictures. It's wonderful.
I also forgot to write this down, but the piano that the fool painted for John, George owned it at one point. It's in the background of the VH1 Yellow Submarine special, and that was at his home. And now I think Donnie Harrison owns it. Not sure though.
Yeah, you would hope they would keep it, and I'm sure they did in some way.
Yasha and Barry had 6 children, fell in love with Jamaica, made reggae music of their own, and spent 19 happy years of marriage together. A documentary called Be the Fool was recently made about their relationship. Sadly, Yasha passed in 1988. Simone had a couple more children of his own, one of whom competed in Eurovision, which is such a random tangent in this story. That is filled with random tangents, really. Simone passed in 2020 and Barry the next year. As of the release of this episode, Marijke Coger Dunham is 80 years old, living on her ranch with her husband Don and their horses. She still makes art to this day, her most recent commissions by the likes of Joni Mitchell. About a failed attempt to stage a Cirque du Soleil-like show featuring her art and costumes, Marijke said this, quote, "It seems my life was full of efforts that did not make the mark." It honestly breaks my heart that she thinks this way. There are so many people out there who recreate her paintings on their own SGs, watch and rewatch Wonderwall, recreate the jackets she made for the Beatles. I saw a girl on TikTok who, like, this was years ago, who replicated the fireplace mural from Kinfons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm making the Patty dress right now. There are so many people who love the Fool's work. Marijke's not just appreciated, she is beloved. She keeps to herself nowadays, but I know for a fact she does see the videos that people make about her. In case she comes across this, I just want her to know how much the both of us admire her and her art. Her intelligence.
Yeah, we really do.
Her intelligence, boundless creativity, quiet wit, and resilience make her one of my favorite ladies of the 1960s. Marijke, you've brought so much brightness and joy to the world. From the both of us, thank you. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life and career of Marijke Coger.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. There's a button around here somewhere. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we would like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro and outro tune. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.